Hello and welcome to Giant Talking, the Volvo Sailing Podcast. I'm Guy Swindles and this week we're in Valencia to look ahead to the showdown, possibly, between Alinghi and BMW Oracle as the America's Cup rolls into town. We also pop over to Perth in Western Australia to find out who the future match race champions may be and look at a UK initiative to get people back in their lasers and back on the water, from grand dames to grassroots, if you like. But first, as always, it's the Volvo Sailing Podcast news headlines. The America's Cup War of Words continues in Valencia, but at least both boats are out on the water. Britain's Ian Percy and Andrew Simpson win the Star Worlds in Brazil. Group Armour 3 heads to Brest, ready for its latest assault on the Jules Verne Challenge. Rob Date's Pew 52 Scarlet Runner takes the Grand Prix at the Audi Docklands Invitational in Melbourne, Australia, while at Key West, the Italians lead in the Far 40s and Melges 24s. Okay, off to Valencia, where despite racing being imminent, Alinghi and BMW Oracle continue to bicker. First up, it's Oracle's Russell Coutts. Here's Russell's rant.
Never in the history of this cup, I would suggest, have we had such rule complications. And never in the history of this cup has a defender tried to impose such bizarre rules as wind limits on the racing. As one recent example that I'll give you. The deed of gift is pretty clear. It gives each party various rights and or benefits. And one of the benefits that the defender gets is it gets to select the venue. And the challenger generally gets to select the timing of the event. Nowhere in the deed of gift does it give the defender the right to also select the wind conditions that the boats will race in. They get enough of an advantage selecting the venue. And yet, what do we see today? We see a situation where they're trying to impose wind limits on the competition. And not only that, the measurement is at, lo and behold, 60 metres. 60 metres? I would suggest that the race committee will not have the capability to measure the wind heights at 60 metres, even if they should. And let me tell you why they've done that and why it's so important, because people say, well, how come we've got all these disputes? How come it's ongoing? The reason it's so important is I can tell you now, Alinghi's boat is very, very fast in light winds, and our boat is very, very fast in strong winds. That's the way it's turned out after all this development from both teams. And what I'd suggest is so much so that it may not even be a close race. If we get very light winds, I'd suggest that Alinghi's going to have a pretty big advantage. And if we get stronger winds, I'd suggest that the advantage looks to me like it'll swing the other way. And so nowhere in the deed of gift does it give the defender the right to choose the wind limits. Yet here they are trying to impose it on the competition to suit themselves and create a totally one-sided competition. And so that's why we've had to go to the international jury to try and resolve some of this stuff. You guys, I was saying before, but guys and ladies, imagine if you had in sports the situation where one of the parties all of it could decide to change the rules at any time. Imagine in a football match if one of the players suddenly decided, hey, look, you know what, it'd be much better for me if I had the right to pick the ball up and run with it. Well, it wouldn't be football anymore, it'd be rugby or something else. And Mr. Bertarelli used the example of a sales the other day, saying that if they're not allowed to use their sales, it's like Roger Federer not being able to use his tennis racket. But Roger Federer doesn't go to Wimbledon and try and attempt to use an illegal tennis racket. He plays by the same rules as all the other contestants in the match. And what's even more bizarre about this is the other side saying, hey, listen, let's just go and race. Let's just go and race and we'll sort all these issues out afterwards. Well, let's stick with the tennis example for a moment and imagine that one of the tennis players turned up to Wimbledon and said, hey, look, yes, okay, there's a dispute over my tennis racket, but let's just play the game. Let's just play the tournament. And after the end of it, we'll let the rules officials sort this out, and we might have to reverse the result. But you know, let's just get this battle back on the tennis court where it should be. Can you imagine a more bizarre situation than that? It's just totally unacceptable. So we're asking for the rules to be sorted out before the event, and frankly, I don't think that's unreasonable. And certainly the way we read the deed of gift, constructed in country is one of the fundamental rules. Constructed in country does not mean building your sails in Minden and then claiming that they're Swiss made. Somebody gave me the example today that this might be a little bit like baking a cake. If you create the ingredients yourself, you put the ingredients, you mix the ingredients up, you then put it in a mould, you then cook the cake, you then pull it out of the mould. And then you say, it's a cake, right? It's certainly a cake at that point. I think most of us would agree on that. And then you take it somewhere else and you put the icing on the cake and you put some candles on it. And you say, oh, well, by putting the icing on the cake and putting the candles on it, you know, that was actually really making the cake. All the rest of it didn't matter. And so what I'm saying to you is there's been rules in this competition now for 158 years. You know, since this race started, important rules that we believe one side should not unilaterally be able to ignore at their whim and be able to change the rules to suit themselves. And so, ladies and gentlemen, that's what this whole argument has been about from day one. And when you look back even to the early days of settlement opportunities that there's been, we've created what I believe, right up until recent days, some very reasonable settlement opportunities. And in fact, when you look at our latest complaint about their sales, we've even offered them more time, if they needed it, to create deed legal sales in Switzerland. And I would suggest that they can do that. Of course they can do that. I think most people that are connected with sailing in this room know that they can build deed compliant sales in Switzerland. That's all we're asking. And we even offered them a little bit more time to do that. And what do? They turn around and say, oh, see, these guys are trying to delay the event. Well, I'll tell you something. If that's the way they want to be, we'll go racing on February the 8th and we won't give them more time to build their sails if that's what they want. Okay? So I think that was a very generous offer. And I spoke to Mr. Ellison about that offer to try and, one, sort the rules out before the competition starts, and two, make them a reasonable offer so that they can still come to the water with a decompliant and legal boat and race us. Okay? If they don't want to do that, then frankly, we're not going to allow them to break the rules as they like in this competition.
Next, Matt Sheehan tracked down Alinghi's Brad Butterworth.
Well, Brad Butterworth, skipper of Alinghi, we're here in Valencia, just over 2 weeks to go now until the Cup. I suppose the big question that's on everybody's minds is, will it really happen on the 8th?
Well, I'm thinking it is, yes. I mean, not being a lawyer, I don't know whether the court case that's about the sales or construction in country, what the timing will be for that, but we're working towards the 8th and we don't actually see another date other than the 8th, and so roll it on.
And is it true to say that actually the only way that it could actually be another date is if there's mutual consent between the teams?
Yes, I think there has to be mutual consent, but also there's actually been we got sued about the date and the venue, and so you'd have to change the court order, I think.
So, given that there's been a lack of mutual consent for quite some time, it doesn't look that likely that that's going to happen.
Yeah, no, there'll never be mutual consent.
Now, looking ahead, assuming it gets kicked off on the 8th, what's your guess as to how long it'll take to get three races kicked off, given that you're looking for some very tight weather conditions in which to sail?
Well, the last week we've sailed 5 days, I think. You would have got a race, I think you would have raced 4 of those 5 days. So I'm thinking that, I'm feeling quite optimistic that it's going to happen quite quickly.
Now, you've both teams have been watching each other very closely over the last year. You're both well aware of each other's boats. What's your feeling about how close the racing, I mean, will the racing be close, or, you know, how far apart are these boats?
I'm not sure about it's hard to gauge their boat. we don't really have exact measurements of them, and, you know, and we won't really know until we line up against them. But I think that one boat or the other will be considerably faster than.
Oh really? You think that there will be a big difference?
I think there'll be a big difference, and I think it'll be quite apparent quite quickly. And you know, you'll just because they're so different, you know, they're just so different in terms of the way they've been put together and the way they are. The one's a trimaran with a wing mast, and the other one's a catamaran with you know, soft sails.
So it sounds like sort of more of the same, and that one of the things that's always talked about in America's Cup is that when it kicks off, the first 5 minutes as you come off that line may well give us the biggest clue we're ever going to have as to who's going to win.
Yeah, I think so. I think the first 5 minutes you'll see, you know, barring breakages, which could happen too. I think there'll be one boat that's probably got a good edge on the other one, or quite a bit quicker, and that'll be probably the end of it.
And you mentioned breakages. I mean, gear failure has been a large part of the development of these big machines, and quite understandably, given how far outside the normal envelope they are. Do you think that the potential for gear failure is still is going to be a big factor in the Cup?
Yeah, I think there'll be there's still, you know, room for that to happen, and you know, every day you learn something a little bit more about these boats. But when you're forced to race, it's a bit different than just training on your own. And you know, everybody puts their foot down a little bit harder on the accelerator, and you know, if the wave height gets big, it'll be I think you'll find that both boats are you know, could find themselves, you know, getting close to breaking you know, big items on their boat. So it's you know, it'll be, hopefully we'll be able to stick with you know, a realistic wind range and have a good regatta.
Now, you talk about that realistic wind range, and of course this is a huge course compared to a normal course, 20 mile beat, 20 mile run. I mean, what are the chances of actually having conditions that are sort of the same at the top as they are at the bottom of the course?
Well, I think they are yeah, I think you'll always have different conditions over the race, but it's you know, at least we have a guide of what we have to sail in, you know, so that it's the same for both teams. And I think with the way that they, you know, with the guys who've got to run the races, I think it'll be done very well.
And you talk about the guides for the racing. The notice of racing and sailing instructions have been fiercely debated over some months now. How do they get approved? Is it, in order for them to be valid, do they have to be agreed by both sides, or is that a jury decision?
No, this is a dog match. And, you know, it's the organising authorities, SNG, which is the defending yacht club, and they can write the notice of race and the sailing instructions, and if they wanted to be, you know, completely dictatorial about it, they would just hand them out as written by them. But we've gone through a process of including the other team in it. We've given them drafts and we've changed things around it, and also with the jury. So, you know, everybody's seen them, and okay, they don't like five items on it, but I think, you know, they should get over it and get sailing.
Now, few people have ever sailed with a solid wing. Even fewer have raced in an America's Cup with one. But multi-hull guru Cam Lewis was aboard Stars and Stripes in 1988. He tells Matt what it was like and how BMW Oracle's wing might stack up against Alinghi's soft sail configuration.
Cam Lewis, so there's a lot of talk about wing sails at the moment, and you've seen one famously in 1988. How do you rate this against what you saw back in that Cup winning 88?
Well, it's certainly leaps and bounds larger, and looks a little simpler in the way it's put together from what I've seen. I have not seen it firsthand or actually been for sale with it, but it just looks like a fantastic piece of technology. Pete and Melvin said they're a bit involved with it, but they have so many people working for the BMW Oracle team that are obviously rocket scientists. I don't know if they stole them from NASA or what they're doing, but if Tom Witten's going to the moon in a balloon, or Mars in a balloon, I mean, these guys have really pushed the envelope hard, I'm sure, within whatever constraints they had for time and building materials. But There's a lot of unobtainium in this wing, I'm sure, and you know, no limits on the type of materials they could use. It just, you know, looks fantastic, simple, and you know, I'm not an aerodynamist, but simply a wing mass sail combination like they have there, without a jib in the front upwind, they should be able to have the wind hitting the wing at about 8 to 9 degrees apparent wind angle, whereas a typical soft sail wing mass combination, such as on the Alinghi Cat, is probably more 12, 13 degrees apparent wind angle. So ideally, the wing sail should be 2 or 3 degrees more efficient upwind. And then
for the same speed.
For the same speed. And or maybe faster. I don't know. Even speed, you know, sort of weight and drag and stuff like that. But the wings should be more efficient upwind. And then, of course, with the addition of downwind Jennikers, whatever you want to call them, big flat jibs, the downwind will probably even out.
That's quite an advantage, though, to have, you know, even just a few degrees on your opponent upwind, especially in a match race.
Of course.
I mean, do you think we'll see that straight away as they come off the line?
Well, if they come off the line clean and they're both going, it's hard to know because there's so many other elements working in it. You obviously have the trimaran, there's probably more windage. You have a windage of the platform, windage of the rigging, and so it's really hard to tell. Now, obviously, the foil's underwater and how those are affecting their upwind performance, whether it's the foils, there's a center dagger board on the trimaran, there's a trim tab. So a lot of things you can do, but with a wing, you can sail high and go slower. You can sail lower and go faster. Easier than with a typical rotating wing mast and a sail. They're probably changing the modes from high and fast to low and fast or low and slower.
And on that subject, maneuverability, do you think the wing offers more scope for tighter maneuvers than a soft sail? And if so, does that then give them an advantage when it comes to a pure match race?
Well, I would have to imagine that the wing would be much easier to maneuver. The loads, you don't have a main sheet load. The main sheet loads on a Alinghi's, the clue, just the load path, have, I mean, I don't know how many tens of tons you have to deal with. On the wing sail mast, there's no main sheet loads except for laterally, in and out. And then 88 in the cup, I was the grinder. I just pulled the wing in, Carl Buchan let it out, and Duncan McLean, who's with Alinghi, he had changed the camber and the twist. So they're much easier to maneuver, to sail with, less loads, faster to trim. Now with engines, it's a whole different deal. So they replaced the grinders. I don't know, on the Alinghi, they just push a button and have an engine go, and I'm going to see how red they turn when the engine craps out or they run out of fuel or something happens. But
take us back to 88 when you were sailing Stars and Stripes with that wing. I mean, did you, one of the things that people are talking about now in this current cup is that Oracle, in fact, both teams have had very little time to develop monster machines. But when we look at the wing, that's another level out there. They haven't had much time to develop it. How much time did you have back in 88, and how much of a worry was it that you did or didn't know enough about the wing when you went off to the match?
Well, you have to remember in 88 we had some C-class cats. We had two Formula 40s. We narrowed those down, put bigger rigs on them. Those were training boats. We had two 60-foot identical catamaran hulls and platforms. One, the first meeting, I remember Dennis said to Tom Omohundra, who was building the mast, how long can you make the mast? Because originally it was going to be 90 feet. He said, well, we can make it 100. Well, it's 100 it is. So we had a 100-foot mast on the soft sail boat. Then the first wing came out, and that was only 93 feet tall. So immediately we have a 100-foot mast on the soft sail boat and a 93-foot wing. Like, well, we need a bigger wing. So 1-800 Mojave Desert, and next thing we have a 113-foot tall wing. That's what Tom Wood and I agreed on the other day. It's 113 feet tall. So we had two wings. We went through wing one, and wing two is 20 feet taller, more area. And as we used to say, the word malaria is like more area, so more sail area all the time. So we had really good testing between the soft sail 100-foot mast, the small wing, and as a proving ground, what we could do. So when the second wing showed up, of course, it was always a time crunch to debug it and tune it and make sure it was going to be reliable because we had a best of three series, there's a lot on the line. So we were able to get that wing, and it was pretty much I don't remember any big problems. A couple of little components needed a little repairs here and there and such. But it was, we had a whole team of wingnuts, as they, I'm sure, do in San Diego now with me and Oracle. And we had fantastic ground support. Obviously, logistically, getting the mast up and down, the wingsail up and down. We had this incredible flipmobile, picked the boat up out of the water, put in the flipmobile, and tipped it over at night. I don't know what those guys are doing, but the wings are very reliable. I mean, you build them with some safety factor, and I'm sure they've had teething problems, but they'll figure it out. You know, I'd just be curious as to what they're using for shrouds to hold it up. I mean, the carbon, the PBO, what the deal is. So. Yeah. But
when you went into the match in '88, how much did you know about the big monohull? Were you confident that you could run circles around it, or what was it like? Or weren't you sure when you came off the line? What was it like those first couple of minutes?
Well, first of all, the trick was not to engage and get broken. You know, don't want to. You know, the match racing is an 88 and such like that. We weren't necessarily scared of maneuverability. I mean, we saw the boat. It was a big, huge white boat, and obviously not very maneuverable. And we were very maneuverable. So as far as engagement, there was. I'd go back and look at the track, but we had one kind of little almost crossing situation, but you know, we just basically sailed away. So it was just, no reason to engage in it and take risk. It was a risk management situation. And
how long before you were pretty confident that you were going to walk away?
Oh, I don't know, there's never a question. And the trick is we could sail the wingboat with six. We had a bunch of guys on the team. We ended up with nine on board each of the two races. And we were, I think Dennis was scared of the courts and beating them by too much, so we weren't using our fastest, best sails to go around the course. And, you know, we're basically, you know, today, looking back at 88, we were not, you know, showing our A game.
Now we move away from the Cup and go down under to Perth and the Warren Jones International Youth Regatta, named after one of the key men in Australia 2's America's Cup win in the 80s. John Robertson tells us how the event's turning into something of a match racing stepping stone, with Adam Minoprio and Torvar Minsky amongst the recent winners.
When he died back in 2003, it was decided that we definitely had to do something to keep his memory and his involvement with sailing alive. So, and he was always very, very involved with the youth of Western Australia, with getting kids on the water and all that sort of thing. So it was decided that a youth regatta was suitable, and because obviously of his involvement with the America's Cup, it was decided that match racing was suitable as well. And since the first event in 2003, which was a pretty domestic affair, the regatta has really developed now and is really one of the premier international youth match racing regattas in the world, and is seen by many as a stepping stone from the regular youth circuit to the senior circuit, in that most youth events are sailed in small boats, three-person boats with small teams, whereas the Warren Jones Regatta is sailed in 36-foot boats with a crew of five. They're identical to the boats that are used at the Monsoon Cup, which is the final event on the senior tour each year. So it's really, it's a step up for these kids. It's a step up from what they're used to, and it lets them know what the senior circuit is really like. It really has proven to be a star maker.
What is it about the event, do you think, that has brought people like that through so quickly?
I think because they have to step up their, not only their sailing ability, but their team management ability. Let's face it, Perth in Western Australia is pretty isolated. And people have to get here. They have to get a whole crew here, or else they have to come here and find a crew and inspire that crew to do well. So it's a whole step up from just three guys getting on a plane, going somewhere and sailing a little boat. It's getting five people here to an event that has bigger boats, and that is a whole new logistical level and a whole new match racing level. So I think that's really why kids come out of this, and only the ones that really try hard, the ones that put in a big effort, can actually get here. And so they put in the effort, they've got here, and they've attained a new level in everything that's required of a team of match racers, not only on the water, but of logistics and everything else. And I think that has really adds tremendously to this regatta.
Is that something that you feel is important for the event, to get that international flavour?
Well, I think it's not only important for the event, but it's important for the what is becoming a Southern Hemisphere circuit. So they can come here, they can go on to the James Hardy Regatta in Sydney, they can then go on to, there's another event in Wellington, so it makes it worth their while coming halfway around the world to, you know, to create a bit of a circuit that will help to bring more people down here. And yes, I think getting young people of that age to experience international competition. I know from when I was that age, I was a bit older, I was about 25 when I started doing international training, you make friends, and I still stay, when I travel the world, I still stay with some of the people that I met when I was first sailing at that level, in the States, in New Zealand. So it helps to create an international bond of kids who will go around the circuit. Well, on the water, they'll kill each other, assure they're great mates. And I think that's fantastic for the sport of sailing.
Finally, it's back to Blighty and a new initiative from the RYA and Laser Performance to get people back on the water and back in the many lasers that just seem to be lying around at the moment. Laser Performance fleet sales manager, James Lundlack.
It was pulled together by Laser Performance and the RYA, and it's an initiative aimed at the club sort of grassroots sailor. And it's all about getting all those hundreds of lasers, which we all know exist in the boat parks of the clubs around the UK, back out on the water. And it came off the back of some work we did with the South Cerny, who did a program of their own where they just did some simple stuff, putting all the lasers in one area in their club, creating some activity so people were talking. You know, this one guy called John Hammond didn't give anybody a reason for why they couldn't sail, so, you know, my tiller's broken wasn't an excuse, because he said, well, I've got a spare tiller, so you've got to use this. And just giving people, just really pulling everyone together, not giving them a reason to not take their lasers out. And from having four or so sailing, they now have 20, 25 boats regularly competing. And so we've used what they did and taking it into a sort of a model that we can work between the builder, us, and the governing body, the RYA, and roll out basically workshops all around the country, 11 workshops, which six clubs can come to. So we want quality rather than quantity. When I mean quality, I mean proper time with people rather than, you know, a room full of people. And then helping them get their lasers back out on the water. And at the end of the day, they have to go away with three ideas, which is then followed up by regional club coaches who go into the club and help them deliver these ideas. And it could be writing a sport development plan, it could be purchasing new spares, it could be anything, but the goal is to get the lasers back out on the water and to really help the clubs.
Do you see this initiative being rolled out elsewhere?
We would love to roll it out elsewhere, but it's like all these things, I think you've got to make it work in one place so you can prove that it's a viable initiative. And I think if we can make it work in the UK and continue to make it work, then there's no reason at all why we couldn't run it in other countries through our dealers, through the other governing bodies. But I think it's really key that we focus on it within the UK and make it, as I keep saying, make it work, and then take it to the other governing bodies.
Well, that's it for this week. Join us again next time when we'll have more from Valencia and more from the world of sailing. But remember to check in at regular intervals to www.volvooceanrace.org.